Welcome, this is Mark Steiner. We're about to have a conversation with Cliff Durand. The book he edited, co-edited, is called Recreating Democracy in a Globalized State. Some of you may recognize Cliff's name. He was here at Morgan State University for 40 years, where he's a professor of social philosophy. He's now research associate at the Center for Global Justice in Mexico, which he co-founded in 2004. He's also coordinator of the research network in Cuba and has led trips annually to Cuba since 1990 and knows the country. A veteran of the civil rights movements, the social movements of the 1960s, of course. And he helped co-found what was an institution here in Baltimore that many people have frequented and had offices in 1982. The Radical Philosophy Association Progressive Action Center is a place that they created. It was an old library they turned into a center for radical politics here in Baltimore. And Cliff joins us now in studio. He was here in Baltimore for a couple of weeks and spoke at Red Emma's and many other places and Morgan State University and spoke at Howard University and joins us here in our studios in Hamden on Chestnut Avenue. And Cliff, welcome. Good to see you again, man.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So just a little background. You taught at Morgan for 40 years.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I came in 1963, fresh out of graduate school at Johns Hopkins, where I ended up with a master's in philosophy, and had been very active in the civil rights movement. And you know, in the 60s, it was the high point here in Baltimore. And when I left Hopkins, I looked for a position at a historically black university so I could continue my involvement in struggles for social justice. And liked it so much, I stayed there for the whole of my teaching career.
So, and then you went off to Mexico to create this institute.
Yes, yes. After retirement, I moved to San Miguel de Allende in Mexico with a couple other retired academics from the Radical Philosophy Association. We were interested in globalization, and we wanted to be able to see it up close from the point of view of the global South. And what better place than Mexico, which was being transformed by NAFTA.
And I want to talk about that, too, in a bit, because you read a great deal about Mexico and the chapters that you wrote, that one chapter you wrote especially about globalization. But we talked a bit before we went on the air about how to define the central themes that you talked about in your parts of the book that you edited. And you have an entire chapter on state versus nation, which is an interesting concept. I mean, we all know about the nation state, as you write about, but it's you get more into the complexity of what that means.
Yeah, yeah. One of the major theses of the book is that globalization is transforming nation states into what we call globalized states. Nation states represented a kind of fusion of the nation, the people, with the political institutions of the state. And the state was, the instrument by which the people were able to express and implement their collective will. But with globalization, the transnational the corporations that were based in the nation have transnationalized, have globalized, and they've in effect jumped the borders of the nation, and as they have done so, the state, which was accustomed to serving their interests, promoting business, investment, and all of that stuff, has tended to follow them also, so that the nation states are being transformed into states less attuned to the interests of their national populations and more to the interests of corporations, that interests that lie quite elsewhere. And are often, in fact, opposed to the interests of the people.
But, and I hear what you're describing. But the struggles between states still exist, even within. I mean, just because let me parse out for us then. I mean, the idea that international global capital, this transnational capital, is, as you write about, goes beyond borders, and capital itself is intertwined. The money is intertwined internationally. And how we structure where manufacturing takes place and who buys what where is kind of all structured in a very global scale, which we'll talk about in more depth. But you still have national interest. In other words, China and the U.S. may have, and the various powers of wealth in those nations may have may interact in very intimate ways, but they still have national interests that set them apart,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Well, or claim to have interests that are nationally.
You say that doesn't exist.
No, there are certainly rivalries and competitions between states, but insofar as states are serving the interests of corporations, then though policies may be cloaked in the language of national interest, in fact, they often are quite disparate from that. For example, free trade agreements. Free trade agreements, beginning with NAFTA, as well as the more recent ones that were adopted this past year with Colombia, Panama, and South Korea, were sold to the public as helping promote trade, promoting the export market from the United States, providing U.S. consumers with lower-priced consumer goods. All of that's the rationale. But in fact, what the free trade agreements have been about much more has been not the movement of goods and services across national borders, but the movement of capital, investment, direct foreign direct investment in other countries. And as that has happened, corporations have moved their production abroad and at the cost of jobs.
How does that tie into the fact that countries like China, which is a national capitalist state, it's not a mm-hmm. communist state, it's a state that we're almost fascist in the classical sense of the term, that they own a significant or invest a significant amount of money in the debt of the United States of America. So how does that complicate your analysis of the national state question being transnational? That seems to me puts into play the potential of state versus state, despite the transnational globalization, and you might even add into that that it might fight for who becomes the dominant nation in this transcapital world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bringing China into the World Trade Organization during the Clinton years,
right.
that occurred. Was seen as a way to bring China under the global governance institutions that the United States had been promoting ever since the end of World War II, with the World Bank and the International
IMF.
Monetary Fund, and later the World Trade Organization. These were designed to provide a way of governing trade relations between countries so as to avoid the kind of interstate rivalries that had given rise to two world wars. And, of course, that was done under U.S. hegemony, which is really the dominant state that led the war-devastated countries that came out of World War II.
Yeah, the great quote by Madeleine Albright stating that in this book that I'll try to find before mm-hmm. in a minute. Yeah,
the United States is the indispensable nation.
That's the quote, right.
Right.
Exactly.
Because it helps to maintain that world order that it constructed in the post-war period. It, through the Marshall Plan, helped to helped Europe to recover from the devastation of the war and was not worried about the fact that there would eventually arise European competitors in global markets. And I think that the thinking in the U.S. with regard to China was that, similarly, China can be brought into world markets that are rule-governed, and there would not be the need to worry about competition. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some in the foreign policy establishment that are certainly worried about the growing economic importance of China, and with that, the possible diplomatic importance as well.
Going back to describing, I want you to read the paragraphs. I want you to be able to describe kind of the theory you're laying out about how transnational capital developed, what it means for the planet today, and the power it has and what it means. But what are you about to read to us? I'm sorry.
Yeah, let me just read a couple short paragraphs here that gives gives you a flavor of one of the themes developed in the book, in fact. Transnational capital now roams the planet in search of accumulation. Yet the state still functions to serve the interests of the transnational corporations, even when that is against the nation in which it is based. Thus, the globalized state finds itself against the nation. With neoliberalism, the state, in both the core and peripheral countries, has abandoned the people in serving the interests of transnational capital. As a result, national popular classes have little reason to accept the political elite that has betrayed their trust, or even to accept the system of capitalism that it serves. This presents a legitimation problem. As neoliberal globalization has transnationalized capital and globalized states, it pits those states against their nations. More and more, as the state is globalized, it is no longer able to promote the common welfare. It acts to prevent it often. This can be seen when it keeps wages low in the name of competitiveness, when it keeps workers disorganized. Capital has long dreamed of a union-free workplace. Loosening health, safety, and environmental regulations. Get government off our back, intoned Ronald Reagan. Lifting the tax burden from capital as an incentive to investors, thereby starving social programs. Encouraging corporations to move offshore, taking jobs with them, and on and on. When the people cry out in protest, the state responds, "The market made me do it," feigning impotence in the face of the very market that it helped to create.
It's hard to deny that there's not this huge body of people in the United States of America that, on the right and the left especially, that are angry about where things are. And there's a large body of people who would consider themselves neither right nor left or anything else who are equally as angry and disgusted with where America is and where we're going. You see it even in those on the right and the left and other parts, everything in between, who are voting for either party, but because they have no place else to go, they could vote Green, Libertarian, but most people don't want to do that because they don't feel they have no place to go. This is the game in town. So what does that mean? I mean, so that's the reality. But the reality is that the other part of the reality is that anger at where the government is and where American society is going is fueled, depending on who you are, from very different histories and very different social perspectives because of that history. So and race and racism plays into that deeply in terms of how you view the society. And as someone said to me the other day, decent, lovely man, and he's known him for a while, Vietnam vet, pretty conservative, white, and said, we got to vote against all this stuff because America will no longer be America. The salt of the earth guy. I mean, get the shirt off his back. The reality is we have very different views in America of why we have this hostility and where it comes from. So, when you talk about building a different kind of democracy, a real democracy, I mean, how those contradictions and what you talk about with transnational capital fit into that reality.
Yeah. Well, there are two major parts to that question. To address the first part to begin, the hostility toward government was what the promoters of the Tea Party played upon.
The billionaire promoters of the Tea Party. They played on the anger of people, mostly white people in America.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. They played upon that anger, the feeling that they had been betrayed, and they blamed it on government and issued a call for less government, smaller government,
right.
All of that.
The betrayers, the one who betrayed us in the first place, used the billions on the betrayed to make them think that they should be angry about it. But they'll be angry at us, even though they're the ones we did it.
Yeah, that's right. It was Koch and Dick Armey and other political operatives who organized and financed Fox News that promoted the Tea Party. in order to focus attention on government away from the financial interests of capital. The genius of Occupy Wall Street is that it refocused the attention. You know, the problem was not in Washington, the problem is in Wall Street. You know, Washington has long been occupied by Wall Street. And so, you know, this movement sought to refocus attention on the source of the problem and where the changes have to come from, where the changes have to be made. The idea being that rather than abandoning government, we should make government the instrument of the democratic will of the people. And that's going to take a major social movement. You know, Occupy Wall Street was only the very beginning of that movement. And the anger that was expressed there is still very present in the society at large, even though the occupiers have been extracted from their so-called public space that they had occupied. But it's there, and it will reemerge. What we've seen is only the beginning of this social movement, which I'm confident in, if not the months, the years ahead, will grow immensely. On the other point about racism, like so many people in 2008, I was heartened by the fact that this country was able to elect its first African-American president. And by a sizable margin, an unusually high voter turnout and a clear mandate there that I saw as the fruition of the civil rights struggle of the 60s, a representation of the fact that at least a sizable portion of the society has is prepared to accept a multicultural society. But then there was the reaction against that. The birthers and all of those who saw an African-American president as somehow or another an alien presence, as threatening America, threatening their sense of its identity. And I think there are strong historical reasons for that. This country was founded as a white nation. We should never forget that. And for many, their notion of the country is that it is and must always be a white nation. Oh, sure, we can accept minorities and so on, but not as symbols of the country. And you know, and so for those whose own self-identity was very strongly tied to being an American, this presence of a black president was a threat to their very sense of who they were. And I think that goes far to explain the vehemence of the reaction of a portion of the population to the Obama presidency. It has laid bare the fact that though a majority of the population accepts the notion of a multicultural country, there is, well, maybe as much as a third of the population for whom that is anathema.
So tie up for us, I mean, if you have another piece you want to read, I'd like to kind of tie up the pieces of your book here, and your three chapters in this book anyway, mm-hmm. that you edited, and with Cliff Durand's book here, we're talking about Recreating Democracy in a Globalized State, that he edited with Steve Martinot. Martineau. I don't know if it was a nod or a no. It could be either one. He's a no. Okay.
Let me just read a couple paragraphs here in the concluding chapter, which is titled The Possibility of Democratic Politics in a Globalized State. And coming off from Madison's design of a polyarchy to prevent democracy, I make the point that globalization of the state offers a new prophylactic to democracy. Now it is the market and global competitiveness and the rules of free trade that have been inserted to prevent democracy. The citizenry is told that they can no longer protect themselves from predatory practices of foreign corporations because their representatives entered into treaties that protect investor rights against the democratic will of the people and enabled the free flow of capital, thereby facilitating capital and corporate flight. Workers are told that they must surrender hard-won wage and benefit agreements so their employers can remain competitive in the world market, or so the company will not ship their jobs abroad to a low-wage country. Austerity is imposed on the people in order to assure investor confidence. Now, that's an interesting term, investor confidence. I read it as a code word that conceals the fact that the vote of the wealthy in financial markets trumps the people's vote. Well, it is against such betrayals of the national interest. It is against this treason by the state that democratic struggles must be directed. A globalized state has a chronic legitimacy problem. In a nation state with a polyarchic political system, elections can confer some legitimacy on the rulers. But when the state functions to promote the interests of transnational capital rather than those of its own people, then elections lose their meaning. What does it matter who you vote for if all your representatives are compelled to tread the same path, no matter what they vowed to you prior to polling day?
So tie that up for us in words, since you've written this book, about where you see us, how you tie this, your analysis of this, where we have this transnational capital, how it's transformed the nature of our society here in global society, and where you think that takes us next. Not that you're a prophet, you're a professor in philosophy, not a prophet, but...
One can crystal ball and try to envision the future, but it's in many ways unpredictable. One thing that is certain is that there is a major crisis of capitalism that we are facing. The financial crisis of 2008-2009 was only, the tip of the iceberg. And I expect that crisis, which is basically a crisis of over-accumulation, will continue to haunt us for some time. How the future plays itself out will depend not only on, basic underlying economic trends, but on how people respond to that. And I put my faith in the emergence of social movements like Occupy Wall Street. Just as in the midst of the crisis of the 1930s, it was popular struggles that forced the Roosevelt administration to adopt what we came to know as the New Deal. A kind of social liberalism or welfare liberalism that gave at least a half a loaf to desperate people. And my hope is that something like that can be done now. Not necessarily that a New Deal is going to solve the current problems, but with major social movements, there will be the opportunity to perhaps explore in new directions. For example, as the Obama administration came into office in the midst of that crisis, implementing the TARP, the bailout of the banks, it had a unique historical opportunity. When the government came into majority ownership of many of the banks, there was the opportunity to take over the management of the banks. You had to fire the CEOs that had risked and gambled away assets and to redirect the banks to use its resources in a way to promote the common good. It didn't do that.
No, it didn't.
It missed a unique historical opportunity by just giving the money to the banks in hopes that they would use it to lend to small businesses and help out mortgage holders that were underwater. And, of course, they didn't do that. They were interested in their own interests. They used the money to buy up other banks or to pay huge bonuses to their CEOs or to just... to hoard the money to increase their reserves. Well, my hope is that as we face future crises, as we are likely to do, if there is a major social movement that can pressure our political leaders, they will be prepared to take more drastic steps.
Well, Clifton Rand, it's been a pleasure to have you in the studio. I'm glad we found time to get this done since you couldn't come on live while you were here. It's good to have you in the studio live while you are here. And I want to thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
And the book we're talking about is Recreating Democracy in a Globalized State. Cliff Duran is one of the editors of the book. Cliff Duran, of course, is a professor here at Morgan State University for 40 years and is now a research associate at the Center for Global Justice in Mexico, which he co-founded in 2004. And again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.